Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. Tonight we are going to be replaying a broadcast from this past week, having a little bit of technical problems, but from Monday forward we will have those taken care of, either here in the studio or we will be going to the station to do it from their location. But as of tonight, we're going to play a pre-recorded program. We apologize, and we hope to see you back here on Monday. And welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Back in the studio, happy as can be about it. You know, love going out on the road, love those conventions, meeting people, doing all of that. But nothing like being back home in the studio, able to take phone calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You got something on your mind, maybe you heard something last night stuck in your mind, you want to talk about that. Good stuff. A lot of stuff happening today, a lot of stuff to get to. So a big program today. Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. He's going to be here talking about a wide array of topics, one of them being the one-day picket, one-day strike up at Pocono Medical Center up in Monroe County. Also, maybe the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference, you know, some of the other things going on, the possibility of a player's lockout in the NFL, Scott Perry's insane right-wing ploy. You know, it's really all about pandering to the extreme right for the Republicans here in the State House. And, you know, Scott Perry has not failed in that regard. And we're going to talk about that bill later on. So much more. Lori LeBeau, Guild freelance organizer, going to talk about Huffington, the sale of Huffington Post, what that means, and what it's meant for the people who built Huffington Post, the journalists who, you know, worked their behinds off. And surprisingly, and I didn't know this, they don't get paid. So all of those freelance journalists who do all that investigative reporting that so many think is so important to Huffington Post, yet they don't seem to get anything out of it. A couple of thoughts pop into my mind there. Why do they do it? So we'll talk to Lori LeBeau about that because, again, I didn't realize they didn't get paid. And, again, it goes back to that question, why would you do it? So we were at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs conference there in Washington. At a swanky hotel, I got to be honest. Those, as much as I like going to them, they seem to be a bit of a waste. You spend an awful lot of time, an awful lot of money on talking about things. The question now becomes, what's going to happen from today until the next one? What kind of momentum, what kind of action comes out of it? You spend an awful lot of money having a wonderful big celebration kind of conference with a lot of education, a lot of networking that goes on. But at the end of the day, when you've spent all that money, what are you hoping for? What comes out of it? We had a good time talking to people and, you know, picking people's brains. You know, personally, I think moving to a solid green economy is a smart thing to do. I think putting solar panels on buildings, I think retrofitting buildings, rewiring the country, doing all the things that would employ people, especially people in the building trades, is a smart thing. You know, but we've been talking about this stuff for 30, 40 years. Jimmy Carter ran on, you know, the idea of having solar banks and having wind farms and all the things that we still really don't have. I mean, we've got a spattering of them. There are a couple here and there. But we don't have a national policy that encourages us to have wind farms, that encourages homeowners to put solar panels on their homes, that encourages business owners to do this kind of stuff. And I've been saying for years, even back in the Carter years, what we need, building codes. We need local township ordinances. We need every community to say, you know what? From this date forward, we're drawing a line in the sand. Anything built has to meet certain requirements. We do it all the time. I want to remodel my house, for instance. We want to add a room on. Guy came over, the contractor came over, measured our bathroom. Our bathroom is only 6 feet across. There's a code that says all bathrooms must be at least 7 by 9. Our bathroom is 6 by 6. It's just an offshoot bathroom. It's 6 by 6. According to him, all bathrooms now from, you know, such and such a date forward, 7 by 9. So we have the ability to use building codes to shape how we want things to look. Personally, I think every home built from 2012 forward should be energy independent with a grid backup. What that means is any home built in 2012 has to have solar panels, geothermal, wind, whatever. I don't care what it is. Rabbits running around on hamster wheels, whatever. But the house has to be energy independent. It has to meet certain standards for insulation, which they do now currently, but better. It has to be energy independent. And you have the grid that backs it up. So if something happens, something goes down, you have energy. Now, I look at the people in Washington, D.C., folks that we talk to. The power in those areas goes down with every storm. People lose power for days at a time. And I'm saying, well, why do you put up with it? Why not make each home able to produce the energy that it needs? There is absolutely no reason for us in this country in the 21st century not to be able to do this stuff. And I look at the conference, and yeah, there were a lot of great conferences. There are a lot of great minds, people who are saying, you know, this is the kind of stuff we're working on. And where I found this conference very interesting is they brought the smart people with the labor people and said, you know, these are ways that we can use current building trades, current steel workers, contractors, you know, hammer swingers, all of that stuff to engage in the green economy. And LIUNA, the Laborers International Union, had this nice big dollhouse. And I tried to get them to give it to me, and of course they wouldn't. But they had this nice big dollhouse with electricity and all kind of stuff and insulation. And it shows you every room of the house, how you can make it more efficient, how you can, use, you know, certain things to heat it. Really a great display. And it's something that I think most people, and I wish they would throw this stuff on the web so everybody could see it. But this is good stuff. And it will put people back to work. And for me, that's the important part. It's getting folks back to work, figuring out how we create an economy that creates jobs, saves energy, and helps this nation become stronger. Because I think the more energy we can save, the more we can conserve or use smarter, the stronger we're going to be as a nation. And we talked about last night that the president had come out with a proposal to say, you know what, we're going to spend some money building high-speed rail. We need the investment. We need this. Like Eisenhower did back in the 50s with the highway, with the interstate system, we need public transportation. We need high-speed rail. So he came out yesterday and said, this is what we're going to do. Well, Republicans today, they're proposing to cut billions of dollars from the rail, which, again, you know, I'm just kind of shaking my head. You know, what's the point? They've unveiled, and we're going to talk about some of the cuts they want to talk about, but they're proposing. They're cutting. They want to cut $8 billion that Obama wanted. They're going to cut another $1 billion for the EPA. And some of the cuts are just ridiculous. But they want to completely get rid of the whole project that Obama wants to put high-speed rail in. Now, listen to me when I tell you this. Yesterday morning, we cut out of here to get down into Washington for the conference. Or actually, it was Tuesday morning. Yeah, yesterday morning. We sat in traffic, and it wasn't even bad yet. At 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning for over an hour, traffic was backed up for 41 miles when we got into it. Are you going to tell me that we don't need some form of public transportation to get those folks out of their cars, onto trains, and to the job site? You know, just look at that one place. And then multiply it by all the cities across this country. You know, when I lived in Cleveland, it was the same thing. You'd get up, you'd go to work. Rush hour was, it was a nightmare. And that was 18 years ago. It's worse now. What's it going to be in 10 more years here? You come into Harrisburg. It's bad. It's going to get worse because you can't build much bigger roads. So in 10 years of doing more of the same, which is nothing, we're harming ourselves in the future. And, you know, when I first moved to this area, you know, I said the first thing that I heard people talking about was Corridor 1, thought it was a great idea. A train, a light rail, a bus, a dedicated bus lane, whatever, that goes from Carlisle here into Harrisburg, hooks up with other communities in this area, seems smart to me, hooks up with the Harrisburg Amtrak, which should, I got to be honest, should be running into Washington, D.C., or at least into Baltimore to hook that up. There's got to be a way of hooking these things together so that you can jump on a train, maybe take a couple of transfer trains, but get across this country, get across this region without having to drive. Now, I know, you know, the oil interests, the automotive interests, you know, all the people who get the big contracts, the asphalt people, they've all got their special interests. So we're not going to be allowed to talk about that. And it's mostly the Republicans who are saying, no, we don't want to invest in that kind of stuff. You look in Ohio and Wisconsin, the two Republican governors over there, especially that insane guy over in Ohio. They're proud of the fact that they're going to stop high-speed rail from coming to their states. They're proud of it. Kasich, on the night of his election, you know, raised his fist and said, the train is dead. You know, we want to keep burning oil. And when I was sitting in that traffic, I'm thinking, think of how much is being wasted. When I was driving a truck for a living, they said that one of the statistics that the company always threw out at us, at the drivers, was for every hour that the truck idles, just idles, you're using 3/4 of a gallon of gas, or diesel fuel. You're using 3/4 of a gallon for every hour that it idles. Now, imagine, multiply that by 3 lanes of traffic, 41 miles long. Imagine how much oil, how much gasoline, how much is being consumed. And not consumed in a smart way. In probably the least efficient manner possible. Sitting. It's not like anything's going on. So, you know, coming out of that conference, you know, I was encouraged that there were people talking about plans on moving public transportation. There were plans at somehow getting off of the juice, which if we could get our homes off of coal, we could get our cars to use better, get better mileage, but also use more public transportation. You know, we could have a cleaner, greener economy, a cleaner, greener nation. And I don't care where you stand on the political debate, on the climate change, or the political debate between, you know, the tree huggers and the drill baby drillers. Common sense eventually has to play something into this. And even if you're the most fiscally conservative right-wing Lulu, or, you know, you're the one out there on the, you know, walking around that doesn't shower or shave or any of that stuff on the left because you want to preserve water, in the middle you've got to realize that, you know, hey, it's about conserving what we have, using it in a smart way, using it to the best possible for the best possible outcomes. And I don't think sitting on the road idling or doing 1 mile an hour is the best possible way. I'd like to see a better way, a smarter way. And not based on ideology, but based on, common sense. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We're inspired by the youth-led social justice movement in Egypt, and we're excited to have solidarity with workers around the world to stand behind them.
Shauna Bader-Blau of the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center from the Egyptian Democracy Movement Solidarity Rally Tuesday at the White House. Union members joined human rights activists and Egyptians worldwide calling for a peaceful transition to democracy and also called on the White House to intervene on behalf of Egyptian workers and citizens who have been threatened by Egyptian security forces. Workers in Egypt are making their voices heard in this human rights movement with strikes and demonstrations. The AFL-CIO says the labor movement in Egypt played a key role in laying the groundwork for the current widespread protests. Egyptian workers have also formed a new federation of independent Egyptian unions as the democracy movement continues to bring change to Egypt.
Workers have a lot to say about promoting social justice in a country, and when they have strength and organization, they can really come together and speak. Slavery unions are about human rights, are about the collective rights of people in a society to have the ability to fight and bargain for wages and working conditions, improvements in their work sites. And through collective bargaining and organizing, you know, in any country in the world, we can achieve a lot for our families.
Workers are still enduring a jobless hell in the U.S. Jesse Russell reports just how bad it still is.
A Labor Department employment report released on Tuesday revealed that there are still 5 unemployed workers available for every job opening in the United States. Businesses have been holding off on hiring new employees, even though some of the top businesses in the country are sitting on large profit margins. Still, that doesn't mean there hasn't been an uptick in job openings. There are 31% more jobs available on the market than in July of 2009. Economists, however, won't consider the nation in a recovery until there are 2 unemployed workers for every 1 job opening. In December, there are 4.7 unemployed workers, less than the last highest number of 6.3 unemployed workers for every job opening in November of 2009. Nearly 14.5 million people are projected to be out of work. Convincing businesses to start using some of their combined $2 trillion in assets to create more jobs and hire more workers was one of the reasons President Barack Obama held his speech to the Chamber of Commerce on Monday. Businesses contend that they can't create jobs because there simply isn't enough demand in the marketplace.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. This afternoon, workers at the Pocono Medical Center in Monroe County picketed in the bitter cold. Why? Because management refuses to recognize their right to union representation. The Pocono Medical Center employees are represented by SEIU Healthcare PA, who took to the picket line for this one-day strike under the banner of an unfair labor practice. These workers have been fighting for a contract since September. That's why I've got Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO on the line. Frank, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, no problem, Rick. I know you've had a busy schedule the last couple of days as you've been taking the show on the road down to Washington, but no, good to talk with you tonight.
You know, this is a big story in my opinion. This is workers taking to the streets. This is democracy in action.
Well, there's no question it is taking it to the streets, and not to make a comparison to what's going on internationally right now, as we've been all witnessing what's happening abroad. You know, workers are taken to the streets. You know, people are taking democracy to the streets for their social justice. In this case right here, it was a one-day strike today. Up in the Poconos, as you said, Pocono Medical Center. It surely was cold outside, but that really did not deter the folks from coming out. You know, they're out there. This is a classic example, Rick, of an employer that really is hell-bent on breaking the union. You know, these folks organized the right way. They did it all right. They did it in the face of a hostile anti-union organizing campaign that was done a number of years ago when these folks decided to build their union. And they really never let up over the years. And now as they're bargaining and or trying to bargain a contract, they're met with this hostile administration that a not-for-profit healthcare institution like DMC is showing some $22 million in profit. Now imagine that, not-for-profit. That's a good thing.
That
right?
Is good.
I mean, it is a good thing. So we welcome that.
And but, of those profits, the workers should share in it, I think.
Well, there's no question that the most valuable natural resource at this facility are the workers themselves, wall to wall, you know, all of them. And it's just, as you said, there should be at least something. Actually, they have a seat at the table. They did this for their right to collectively bargain.
Right.
And, you know, collectively bargaining is what they're trying to do in good faith. But it's not being met that way with the administration.
You know, I have a friend who says that solidarity isn't just a word, it's an action. And you look at something like this and you go, this is solidarity in action.
Well, and here's what's really troubling about the whole thing, Rick. And, I mean, there's a lot of issues that's troubling, but probably the most is the fact that the administration, the management, is really, quite honestly, trying to take out the union rights clause. Now, when you think about bargaining, and when you think about the profits that PMC is showing, and I know just a little bit about numbers, I think, and let's just try to do the math all together. Your listeners, you, me. What does it cost the hospital to have that union rights clause in? Nothing.
Right.
Nothing. Cost them nothing. But it's all about power. It's about control. It's about the fact that they can't get over the fact that these workers chose to band together 4 years ago for their collective self-interest and their own protection, and the hospital still just cannot get over that.
Yeah, you know, and I guess, you know, looking at this situation, Frank, another glaring example of why we need labor law reform in this country, another glaring example why, you know, pieces of legislation like the Employee Free Choice Act that had some teeth in it need to be passed, a prime example of why we need a more active National Labor Relations Board.
Rick, think about where the hospital is. And up in the Poconos, this is Monroe County. It is a bedroom community, as you're aware, for New York City.
Right.
And actually, folks going over to New Jersey. So you're the tri-state area are three would be considered heavily unionized areas, New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. 2011, that this is happening right now. You know, there's a number of labor board charges that the NLRB has filed and issued complaints against the hospital. For example, for illegally interfering with the workers' rights, just to discuss issues on the workers' own time. Imagine this. imagine, on the workers' own time. So, again, the National Labor Relations Board has been the one issuing the complaint. It's not us. It's not you. It's not me. It's the federal government saying that you're wrong. You know, these workers have an opportunity. They have a right to talk about these proceedings on their own time, as they have been. But they are met with harassment. They've been met with intimidation. And at the end of the day, and I've met these people several times before, and Rick, they're concerned for one thing. Number one, first and foremost, patient care. That's really what it's about. This is a quality institution made that way by those that are providing the service. And, you know, it's a difficult move for anybody to take this kind of action as they did today. They didn't do this hastily. And, again, they did this always with patient care in mind. And I think that has to really be remembered by our listeners. And the community, I think, that should rally behind them, whether it's writing letters to the hospital administration, putting letters to the editors, opinions, being on a radio shows just like this, but talking about that the folks that have used the facility, they understand that it provides a real quality care. And again, it's done by people. And this is a real shame that right now it's been met with this kind of resistance and a failure to recognize that they are such a valuable resource.
Yeah, and again, Frank, I go back to what I said, that we need labor law reform. When it's the National Labor Relations Board who's filing these charges, and still nothing is being done, it makes me think back to when the Teamsters tried to organize overnight transportation, and the judge said the overnight transportation was the worst violator of labor law in the last 50 years. And yet they still got away with it. They still were able to do the things they were able to do and pretty much walk away scot-free.
Do we need labor law reform? You bet we do. I mean, it's such an antiquated system. And, you know, imagine what's happening right now. And just if I may have a slight digression, I thought a little bit about this tonight. You know, I'm still, thinking about the football game on Sunday. And if I lived in the world of PMC and other hostile employers, I would want that game played over and over and over and over again until I was able to beat down the other team that was successful in winning, until I got the score that I wanted, you know, and then I'd be satisfied with it. But we know that's not reality. You know, what happened on Sunday was fair. What happened 4 years ago with these workers was fair. It was a fair election. You have an overwhelming majority of people say that they believe that they are better off and they have more power collectively than they did individually. And these actions and this attitude that the hospital continues to demonstrate is indicative of why they came together 4 years ago. They certainly are not forgetting it. And I got to tell you, you know, the morale was really outstanding. It was exciting to see them. As I said, 24 degrees out there, probably started off at around 4 degrees early this morning. But I'll tell you, several unions came out. It was wonderful to see really just a great diversity of affiliated AFL-CIO unions that were walking the picket line with these workers in that freezing cold. That did not, you know, chill by any stretch of the imagination their spirit.
And good for them. And I hope this does what it's supposed to do, because this kind of stuff, and, you know, I talk to people who say, well, you don't need to strike. And I say, you know, sometimes you need that shot in the arm to get both sides back to the table and talking. Because at the end of this, it's still going to come down to, they're still going to have to negotiate a contract. Both sides are going to still have to make an agreement. And that's where it's going to end up.
You're right. And our message, from our point of view, from the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, is that we're not going to get behind these workers. We're going to be right beside these workers. Yeah. It's going to be arm in arm, and we're looking to work with them. We're looking to move forward with them. And if necessary, quite honestly, we're willing to fight with them. But we hope that we're able to establish some type of common sense dialogue and some real rationale to why It's important that these workers have a voice on the job. And also, we're just trying to figure out why this administration is trying to squash that voice.
So what can I do to help? What can my listeners do? What do we do?
Let's get them on the phone, Rick. Let's get them talking. Let's get them talking about this. The workers, number one, need to understand they're not on an island. And they're part of a bigger movement. You know, nearly 800,000 hardworking women and men in Pennsylvania alone, in addition to the neighboring New Jersey and New York. You know, we want to get those phones going and let them know that they're not out there alone and we're in this with them. And then let's get on the phone and start talking to the administration.
I'm right
Bargain
there.
Bargain the contract.
I'm right there with
Negotiate
you.
In good faith. Put some letters to the editors out there. You know, again, so many people have come through in that area and have used PMC. You know, so tell the stories about the great patient care that they received. You know, from everything to the cleanliness of the facility, the food that is served, the patient care that they received, you know, the mechanics of the facility, that's all done by union labor. And I think that the most important thing is right now is that the administration realizes that this is not just 550 service and maintenance workers. You know, this is something bigger, and we're very serious about their protecting their rights.
All right. Last question I've got for you, not to change the subject, but still talking about workers. You brought up the Super Bowl. There's a possibility of a lockout, which is different than a strike. The lockout's a lot different. But what do you think's going to happen here?
Oh, you know, it is hard to imagine. Two things are hard to imagine. One, that another football season has come and gone so quickly. I imagine it was over for some of our listeners before Sunday. However, it's hard to imagine a season without football. And this is just not about the players themselves. You know, we have to appreciate the fact that there are tens of thousands of ancillary jobs that are involved in professional sports. Absolutely, you have the athletes, who, by the way, belong to the AFL-CIO. They understand the strength in bargaining together. They understand the power of solidarity. As you said, not just in words, but in action. So then you take a look at all the other jobs that are involved, from those folks that work at the stadiums, ground crews, security, cleaning people, nearby restaurants, hotels, wine and spirit shops. You name it, all these are directly impacted by the franchise. Now, in some instances, it's not all of them, but in some instances you have owners that feel the need, the need for greed, I suppose, if you want to, you know, just put it bluntly, that they're really trying to force the players into a place that they don't necessarily feel is fair for them or for the longevity of their careers.
Well,
I think that has to, go ahead.
At the end of it, I think it comes down to one basic fact. Much like the workers that were on the picket line this afternoon, it comes down to being able to share in the wealth that the workers create. And we're going to see a lot of headlines about NFL players making big money, and some of them do, but the vast majority do not. And it's still about the wealth that workers create and the ability to share in that wealth.
That's exactly right, Rick, and think about it. And yes, you're going to hear about the big salary players, but what you're also going to hear about is those players that may only be in the profession for 3, 4, 5 years, just not enough money. What are you doing for the next 30 or 40 years of your life? You know, so that has to also be taken into account as well. So this is really, it's interesting times that we live in, no question about it. And it does go all back to the collective spirit, the power of collective bargaining, folks sticking together, because no matter where you work, whether you're an athlete or a teacher, whether you're a truck driver or a steel worker, you know, there are some forces, unfortunately, still yet, in the corporate world out there. I can't just say corporate America, and it's a global economy. We have to face it. They certainly do not favor workers. Don't put them first. Don't put them second. Don't put them third. And you know, and workers are fighting up. No matter what you do for a living, you know, we know that America works best when we say union yes, no question about it. And that's what's happened, as we have workers standing up all over the country.
Yep. You know, I only hope, my only hope would be that these brave strikers, the people at Pocono Medical Center, get as much attention as the NFL players are going to get if they get locked out. I wish that would be possible.
But I hope it's possible, too. You know, the reality of it is, everybody's condition is important to themselves.
Right.
You know, they made a decision. Again, it was not a hasty decision. They spent a lot of time contemplating this, thinking about it, thinking about their well-being, thinking about the patients, thinking about the institution. But when it comes down to it, it's a wake-up call. They're making a plea, and I hope that the hospital administration and management hears their plea. Listen, we want to work with you. We want to continue to make this a profitable facility. But let us have a seat at the table. Let us help you make it even better, and let us share in some of the fruits of our labor.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Frank. Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. Frank, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Rick.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make history happen!
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com if you miss any portion of the program. Right there for your enjoyment, your entertainment, easily downloadable. You can also watch the video. You can watch us live streaming here in the studio, right there at the program. Scandal has hit the grand old party, or the gay obsessed party, or the GOP again. And another one of them there, God-fearing Christian conservative guys. He got caught with, in this case, got caught with his shirt off. Christopher Lee, the fit, fun, classy guy who described himself as divorced on a Craigslist dating site, was looking for a woman who doesn't mind a 46-year-old man lying about his age and, of course, about being divorced because he's married with kids. Didn't matter. I say divorced because I say was because I'm thinking his wife is going to have his bags packed since he got caught and since he quit his job. Did I mention the fact that he quit his job as congressional representative of New York's 26th district? Yes, Christopher Lee decided, you know what, I got busted. I better give it up. He wrote in a statement, quote, "It has been a tremendous honor to serve the people of Western New York. I regret the harm that my actions have caused my family, my staff, and my constituents. I deeply and sincerely apologize to all of them. I have made profound mistakes, and I promise to work as hard as I can to seek their forgiveness." He goes on to say, "The challenges we face in Western New York and across the country are too serious for me to allow this distraction to continue, and so I am announcing that I have resigned my seat in Congress effective immediately." So it's been about 4 weeks that the Tea Party people, because he was swept in on that boat, it's been about 4 weeks on the job, maybe a little over. And I find it interesting that, you know, he had regret that his, you know, that harmed his staff. I'm like, do you even have a full staff yet? "I have made profound mistakes," plural. So what else have you done in the 4.5 weeks while a member of the House of Representatives? One of those things. But again, another one of these sex scandals, you know. And I go back through some of them that have been, you know, pretty popular. I remember the guy from Bakersfield, California, State Senator Roy Ashburn, who, you know, the traditional family values guy, going to gay bars. He was gay bar hopping. And during the day, going on this, "I'm a God-fearing Christian, you know, hang the queers," kind of rant. But as soon as the night went down, so did he. Kind of a weird, again, you know, I wish these people would just be who they are and not these hypocritical folks that they've turned into. And you can go down the list. There's a whole bunch of these guys that I just, that, you know, stick in my mind. I think of Diaper Dave Vitter, you know, senator from Louisiana who was involved in the D.C. Madam scandal. His name was all over the place. And why? Allegedly, some, you know, they said that he liked to be dressed up in diapers and that he would soil himself and people would clean it up. And they're going, really? That happens? You know, you go back to, you know, you think about this guy, Roland Corning from South Carolina, a state representative, a very married representative. As Attorney General of South Carolina, he was caught with a stripper, sex toys, and Viagra in a cemetery. Really? Did you think you weren't going to get caught in a cemetery? And what's ironic about it is he almost got away with it because someone, one of the people in his office was the wife of the policeman that caught him in a cemetery. You know, and then there's, you know, one of my favorites, you know, Larry Craig, Mr. Toe Tap himself, you know, in the Minneapolis airport, had worked tirelessly against hate crimes, worked tirelessly to deny gays and lesbians the right to really to exist. And there he is, you know, playing footsie under the stalls, you know, saying, "I'm not gay. I've never been gay." Well, you know what they say. One of my favorite of all time, so, is Florida State Representative Bob Allen. My absolute favorite. Back in 2007, he got nailed. He was one of McCain's presidential, you know, campaigns, one of his main guys in Florida. And I love this story. It's just amazing. He says it was raining, and the thunder scared him. So he went into a men's room in the park and there was a very large black man, and he was afraid. So naturally, the fear in him made him reach into his wallet, pull out a $20 bill, and offer to perform certain acts. That doesn't sound to me to be all that afraid. Consider, especially if you just went in your wallet and pulled just $20 out. If you were afraid, you'd give the whole wallet, wouldn't you? Now, understand, this was a guy who wanted to make what he had done a felony, punishable by a mandatory year in jail. I mean, it's this kind of hypocrisy that I find amazing. And people say, well, Rick, you know, I'm sure you've had transgressions. Yes, I have. I've had my problems. I've had my past. I've got skeletons. Everybody does. But you don't hear me saying that people who do these things should be condemned. I don't think this congressman should resign. I don't care what he does in his personal life. I don't care who he sleeps with. As long as he's not a hypocrite about it, saying that others who do what he's doing are wrong. I'm a firm believer of people having a private life and people having a public life. What I want to know is what you're going to do as a member of Congress. What are you going to do for the working people of this country? You know, you look at Senator John Ensign. You know, spent a lot of time on C Street, living in the religious house, talking about how a good God-bearing Christian he is, was one of the promise keepers, one of those really way out there evangelical groups, was out there preaching a good word to somebody else's wife. There's a problem here. And not only did he do that, he tried to cover it up by giving her a whole boatload of money. And yet, he didn't step down. And you go down the list, you know, I think of Pastor Ted Haggard. You know, outwardly, you know, I think I know what you did last night. Yeah, you probably do, because you were doing it too. Out there pushing for legislation as one of the most powerful evangelicals in the country. He was the head of the National Association of Evangelicals. He had meetings weekly with George W. Bush. Weekly. Here's a guy who pushed to make what he's doing illegal. And there he was, sniffing crack off the backside of a male hooker while condemning it. And what I find interesting about Pastor Ted is the fact that all of those Christians who believe in forgiveness ostracized him, shunned him, kicked him out, didn't take him into their loving arms. No, they didn't. They didn't take him into their God-fearing loving arms and embrace him. Nope, didn't do that at all. What they did do is they ostracized him, kicked him to the curb. And, you know, it's this amazement that I have. You know, here in Pennsylvania, you had Don Sherwood up the road, paid his mistress about $500,000 to shut up after allegedly beating her repeatedly over a five-year period that he had this affair with her. You know, while touting the good line. You know, Mark Foley, remember him? Remember Mark Foley back in 2006? He was actually the chairman of the House Caucus on Missing and Exploited Children. The chairman of the caucus. Yet there he was, trying to pick up 15-year-old pages. There he was doing the exact same thing that he was supposed to be fighting against. You remember back in the 70s and 80s? I mean, this isn't something new. Yeah, John Henson. You know, he did the whole alcohol made me have sex with men thing. You remember that? I'm sick. I'm sick. Trust me, I'm sick. You know, it was the alcohol that made me sick. You know, while he was an aide, he exposed himself to an undercover cop at the Iwo Jima Memorial in Arlington Cemetery. And, you know, a whole bunch of stuff. Unfortunately for him, he died of AIDS in 1995. But to his credit, he did turn around and he did fight for rights. And I think about my last favorite guy, a guy named Robert Bauman. He was a congressman from Maryland back in the 80s. I think it was 1980 he tried to hook up with a 16-year-old prostitute and lost his reelection bid. Now he's doing what a good conservative would do. He writes books on how to offshore profits and how to set up tax havens. That's a pretty good thing, don't you think? And let's not forget Governor Mark Sanford, who got lost on the Appalachian Trail. We're going to take a quick break, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We are right back after this.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
When corporate executives needed a political favor, they always went running to Congress. But now, they can also run to the courthouse. Over the years, corporate chieftains and their political henchmen have steadily ensconced reliable laissez-faire ideologues in hundreds of federal judgeships, quietly creating a corporate-friendly path for moving their litigation all the way from the district level through the Supremes. For example, in its effort to scuttle Obama's health care reform, the right wing has gone court shopping. They file their cases in the courts of judges who are known to be ideologically hostile to government regulation of health care corporations. Take U.S. District Judge Henry Hudson in Virginia. On December 13th, he ruled that a key provision of the new law is unconstitutional, a ruling at odds with 14 other federal judges who had dismissed similar challenges. He had to resort to twisted reasoning to reach his decision and keep the right wing's flawed case moving. But hey, you can't let legal niceties get in the way of ideology. Peek under Hudson's judicial robe, and you'll find a naked partisan with a long career in hard right Republican politics. Protege of Ronald Reagan and his detestable Attorney General, Ed Meese, Hudson ran unsuccessfully for a Virginia congressional seat in 1991, then was given two GOP political appointments in the state before George W. lifted him onto the federal bench in 2002. This is Jim Hightower saying, even today, as he sits in judgment of politically motivated cases, Hudson continues to draw annual income as an owner of a Republican political consulting firm. One of the firm's successful clients in 2009 was Ken Cuccinelli, who was elected to be Virginia's Attorney General. Ken just happens to be the official who filed the right wing's case against Obama's health care reform in Judge Hudson's court.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
One 888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. We were in Washington for the last day and a half, and for the Good Jobs Green Jobs conference. And as we were leaving this afternoon, the CPAC people were setting up for their little conference coming up. The Conservative Political Action Committee. Where Sarah Palin evidently is not going to be. And, you know, you had Tricky Ricky Santorum throwing her a shot, saying, oh, well, you know, hey, she's probably making more money somewhere else, you know, hawking her speeches or, you know, doing whatever it is that she does for her dime, if you will. Well, not a dime. They estimate since 2008 when she quit as governor of Alaska, she's made about $30 million a year. And if anybody remembers, the first thing I said the day it happened, the day she quit, I said, this is not about her giving a rat's behind about the state of Alaska. Because I think the only time she's back in Alaska is to film that crummy TV show. That's probably the only time she's there, and they probably build sets so she only has to come back once in a while. She's out there on the road making money, making lots of money. And you know, I look at this CPAC thing, which is amazing. We were sitting there, you know, waiting for our next, waiting to talk to somebody, and all of these young girls came in, really very, very, very attractive young girls. And they all came marching in, and behind them came a bunch of, you know, a bunch of boys, men, young men, not much there, but they were following after the girls. And they were there to do the flyer stuffing into these bags and all of this stuff that has to be done. They were there to do the work. And I asked one of the girls, I said, hey, how much you guys make doing this? How much they pay you? And she wouldn't tell me how much. I said, do you get paid? And she said, oh, yeah, we get paid. I go, how much? And she wouldn't tell me. I established the fact that they got paid. So I asked one of the guys, I said, hey, you guys get paid doing this? And he kind of, shook his head no, and he gave me this he didn't want to say, and he walked away. So I can only extrapolate from that they paid the girls to show up so that the boys would follow. Which, again, without the young girls, there's no movement on the conservative side of the field. So when I came back and I talked to one of the interns here, she said, that's kind of amazing since women are the breadwinners in the family. Maybe they're just, training them to think that way. And it's true. I mean, you look at how the economy has turned. More men are unemployed. More women are the ones bringing home the paycheck. It's really kind of changing this whole national dynamic that I don't think the religious right is happy about or wants to acknowledge. And the reason I bring that up is because at the CPAC conference, we borrowed one of their manuals, one of their guides, some of the propaganda. So we borrowed it, and we were flipping through some of the pages. And this Tom Minnery, he's the senior vice president of CitizenLink. They're an affiliate of the group Focus on Destroying the Family. I mean, Focus on the Family. I would say Destroying the Family, but that's up to interpretation. He wrote this piece under Social and Economic Conservatives Having Much in Common. He writes, quote, sometimes reporters ask us why we don't take on more trendy issues at Focus, like poverty. Let me think about this for a second. I don't see poverty as a trendy issue. I see poverty as a social failure. I see poverty as something that is going to destroy this country. I see poverty as something that destroys families. But his response, and I love this, and again, it's very typical of these social conservatives, these pro-birth conservatives. He says, our response is that we do fight poverty every day in the most effective way possible by encouraging husbands and wives to love each other. That's it. All you have to do is love each other and you won't be in poverty. Stay committed to your children. You won't be in poverty. Never mind that they don't have a job. Never mind that we're cutting social programs, put food on the table. Never mind that the banks are foreclosing on your house, kicking you to the curb. Never mind the economy's in the toilet because the corporate special interests who fund your little group are offshoring jobs at a record pace. Never mind that. All you have to do is work hard and love each other. And he doesn't even say work hard. Just love each other. That's going to do. I think that's right. He goes on to say, incidentally, one more reason why social conservatives stand so firmly for traditional marriage. You like how they turned? Gone completely away from talking about poverty. Brought it up, threw it down. It's like that commercial on TV, I pick things up, I put them down. He picked it up and said, oh, here, don't look at this, and threw it down. One reason why social conservatives stand so firmly for traditional marriage is that the same-sex definition of marriage asserts that the social science is wrong, that parents are interchangeable cogs. Two dads or two moms is just as good as one of each. As public policy, this is social disaster. No, you know what social disaster is, Tom? Kids that go to school hungry. Kids that go to bed at night with their stomachs empty. And your friends and your party taking food out of their mouths. And we're going to see Republicans, and we're going to talk about it today, Republicans slashing the budget on the national level. You're going to see it here on the state level, taking from those who can least afford it, taking from those who are least able to bear the brunt. That's how they're going to balance their budgets on the least among us. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back with Lori Lebo. Stick around.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We're inspired by the youth-led social justice movement in Egypt, and we're excited to have solidarity with workers around the world to stand behind them.
Shauna Bader Blau of the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center from the Egyptian Democracy Movement Solidarity Rally Tuesday at the White House. Union members joined human rights activists and Egyptians worldwide calling for a peaceful transition to democracy and also called on the White House to intervene on behalf of Egyptian workers and citizens who have been threatened by Egyptian security forces. Workers in Egypt are making their voices heard in this human rights movement with strikes and demonstrations. The AFL-CIO says the labor movement in Egypt played a key role in laying the groundwork for the current widespread protests. Egyptian workers have also formed a new federation of independent Egyptian unions as the democracy movement continues to bring change to Egypt.
Workers have a lot to say about promoting social justice in a country, and when they have strength and organization, they can really come together and speak. Slavery unions are about human rights, are about the collective rights of peoples in a society to have the ability to fight and bargain for wages and working conditions, improvements in their work sites. And through collective bargaining and organizing, you know, in any country in the world, we can achieve a lot for our families.
Workers are still enduring a jobless hell in the U.S. Jesse Russell reports just how bad it still is.
A Labor Department employment report released on Tuesday revealed that there are still 5 unemployed workers available for every job opening in the United States. Businesses have been holding off on hiring new employees, even though some of the top businesses in the country are sitting on large profit margins. Still, that doesn't mean there hasn't been an uptick in job openings. There are 31% more jobs available on the market than in July of 2009. Economists, however, won't consider the nation in a recovery until there are 2 unemployed workers for every 1 job opening. In December, there are 4.7 unemployed workers, less than the last highest number of 6.3 unemployed workers for every job opening in November of 2009. Nearly 14.5 million people are projected to be out of work. Convincing businesses to start using some of their combined $2 trillion in assets to create more jobs and hire more workers was one of the reasons President Barack Obama held his speech to the Chamber of Commerce on Monday. Businesses contend that they can't create jobs because there simply isn't enough demand in the marketplace.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Pull out the good old union as to win it to win. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Well, you know, this is another one of those issues, folks. Which side are you on? Well, Arianna Huffington's, you know, collecting $315 million. I'm sure you've heard AOL just purchased Huffington Post for a whopping $315 million. And there's an outcry from readers and contributors that Huffington Post has sold out. And we find out that the people who are putting the all those great articles up, who are doing the investigative journalism, who are doing the writing that the mainstream media chooses not to, amazingly, they don't get paid. Amazing to me. One of those things. And the Newspaper Guild has launched a campaign against Huffington Post. Hey, Arianna, can you spare a dime? They have a Facebook page, facebook.com/heyArianna. We've got a link on our site at thericksmithshow.com. I've got someone from the Newspaper Guild, one of their freelance organizers, Lori Lebeau, on the phone. Lori, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
You know, what's going on here? I mean, I got to be honest. I was shocked when I heard one of the only left-wing, I guess if you call Huffington Post left-wing, outlets bought up by someone who I wouldn't say very, very sympathetic to our cause.
Well, certainly AOL is one of the corporations that Arianna Huffington has, spoken about when she talks about what the corporations have done to middle-class Americans.
So I guess the question then comes down to is, you know, should people who submit these stories to places like Huffington Post, should they be paid? I mean, are they doing journalistic work? Is this something that they should be paid for?
Well, very much so. Now, she does. There are some reporters for Huffington Post who are paid. There are some editors. However, she also has. What about 3,000 bloggers who are unpaid? And many of those bloggers provide really valuable content, regular features for them, and break news for Huffington Post. And those are the people that have not seen any compensation, and they're the people that we're calling on Arianna Huffington to compensate them for the great work they've been doing for her.
Yeah, and it is great work. I mean, you know, I don't go to Huffington Post as often as maybe I should, but there's quality work there. So I guess the question is are there any sites out there? Because I'm someone who wants to consume from a friendly site who treats their people right. Are there any sites out there that do pay their reporters?
There are, you have to keep an eye out for, it's a tough market right now. As you know, the past couple years for newspapers, it's been a bloodbath out there. There have been a ton of layoffs. And as a matter of fact, I can say personally, I know reporters, I've been in the newspaper business for 20 some years. And, I have friends at newspapers all across the country who've gotten these layoffs. And what happens, what we're seeing in a lot of these cases, is that newspaper reporters, they're in it. They've never been in it for the money. They've been in it because they love this. They're just trying to make a wage doing something that they feel passionately for. What we're seeing now is a lot, they're being exploited. This passion, for their desire to work after they still want to stay in the business. They still want to keep reporting. They still want to keep the public informed about everything that's going on in this world today. And so what we're seeing is, people are being, if they're being paid at all, they're being paid pennies to freelance. And that's a terrible situation. And, we're hoping that we can maybe we're hoping that this campaign that we're maybe could be the start of something more to get the word out that, freelancers need a fair wage just like everybody else.
Yeah, I agree. And again, for me, it comes down to a very simple premise. Just like the nurses at Pocono Medical Center up in Monroe County, just like the NFL players who may be locked out, someone who creates wealth should be able to share in the wealth that they create.
I agree. That's terrific. Yes. Yes, if only.
Right. Yeah. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Lori LeBeau. She is a Newspaper Guild freelance organizer. They've launched this campaign called Hey Arianna, Can You Spare a Dime? There's a Facebook page, facebook.com/HeyArianna. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com with Lori LeBeau's name right there for you to click on. It'll take you over there. You know, as we move forward with this, what can I do? What can our listeners do? How do we collectively move this forward?
Well, first off, any of your listeners who are freelance writers, I would encourage them to get in touch with us. The Bay Area has the guildfreelancers.org right out there. That they are one of the first first steps in the Newspaper Guild's new campaign to help organize freelancers. I'm working the East Coast. If they could get in touch with me, my email address is laurilebo@gmail.com. Please email me. I'm on Facebook. And we can talk about maybe, helping set up these individual units and locals to start something, since there are so many freelancers out there and it's become such a bloodbath in the newspaper and the media industry.
Is there a movement? Is there any type of movement towards maybe coming up with a union bug, something to allow, I know Truth Out, I know they they're organized. I know they help their folks.
Yes.
Is there anything that, you know, just for the average reader, you see, like I see when I buy T-shirts, there's a union bug there. When I buy some my business cards, there's a union bug there. Are there any sites with the union label on it so I know that these people are being treated right?
For freelancers, there is an early campaign connected with the Guild Freelancers Org, which would basically be sort of the equivalent of a good housekeeping seal of approval for them. They are starting that process. We're hoping that as we grow these unions, that we will be able to expand that across the country. You know, what we certainly envision someday is that, you know, people who don't, you know, organizations that don't treat their journalists, their freelance journalists, right, will be ostracized because they don't live up to the standards that we need. I mean, you know, what we're dealing here is a lot of people who are struggling. I also work as a freelance writer. I know how hard it is to try to make money when the cost of, you know, what people are willing to pay has been driven down so much in the past couple of years.
Right.
I know people who are making literally, you know, a penny a word in wow. some of these content media farms.
You know, and I think the idea of a good workplace seal is not a bad idea.
We're very excited about it.
Because, you know, as a society, I think at some point, you know, as a kid, I remember growing up with Look for the Union Label songs on TV that made me, you know, as a kid, think about that stuff. I think at some point moving forward, we need to push that out to say, look, these are conditions under which people can make a living. These are professions that we want people moving towards. Because I got to be honest, I want newspaper reporters. I want investigative journalists who are professional and able to make a living because I want to know what's going on.
Well, and I will say, I mean, if you don't have, you know, the idea is that you can get people to work for free, you can't get good journalists to work for free. They have, you know, good investigative journalism takes money and investment and expertise and experience. So, yes, I agree with you completely.
So last thing, what do we do here with the Huffington Post people? Do we call them? Do we email? Do we what?
Well, what we're asking people to do is come check out the website, keep a discussion going. We'll be posting updates as we go this week and into next week on this. We're hoping to create enough of a buzz that Ms. Huffington starts to feel a little pressure and maybe, you know, wants to do something about this.
Do we boycott at some point?
Why don't you follow the Facebook page and see where we go with this?
We will most certainly do that.
Thank you so much.
Lori Lebeau, I appreciate your time. Keep up the good work. Hope to talk to you very soon.
Take care. Thank you, Rick.
We're going to take a quick break right here. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
When corporate executives needed a political favor, they always went running to Congress. But now, they can also run to the courthouse. Over the years, corporate chieftains and their political henchmen have steadily ensconced reliable laissez-faire ideologues in hundreds of federal judgeships, quietly creating a corporate-friendly path for moving their litigation all the way from the district level through the Supremes. For example, in its effort to scuttle Obama's health care reform, the right wing has gone court shopping. They file their cases in the courts of judges who are known to be ideologically hostile to government regulation of health care corporations. Take U.S. District Judge Henry Hudson in Virginia. On December 13th, he ruled that a key provision of the new law is unconstitutional, a ruling at odds with 14 other federal judges who had dismissed similar challenges. He had to resort to twisted reasoning to reach his decision and keep the right wing's flawed case moving. But hey, you can't let legal niceties get in the way of ideology. Peek under Hudson's judicial robe, and you'll find a naked partisan with a long career in hard right Republican politics. protege of Ronald Reagan and his detestable Attorney General, Ed Meese, Hudson ran unsuccessfully for a Virginia congressional seat in 1991, then was given two GOP political appointments in the state before George W. lifted him onto the federal bench in 2002. This is Jim Hightower saying, even today, as he sits in judgment of politically motivated cases, Hudson continues to draw annual income as an owner of a Republican political consulting firm. One of the firm's successful clients in 2009 was Ken Cuccinelli, who was elected to be Virginia's Attorney General. Ken just happens to be the official who filed the right wing's case against Obama's health care reform in Judge Hudson's court. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.com.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you want to jump in here, I would love to hear from you. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Today, back in 1961, President Kennedy asked Congress to approve the creation of the Medicare program. He proposed that Medicare be financed through a small increase in the Social Security tax to aid the 14.2 million Americans at the time, 65 years old and older, to get health care as they grew into their golden years. And you know what? We did that. Took a couple years, but did it. And now one of the most successful programs that we've come up with. Something that, you know, I look at my grandparents who have been retired for, my grandfather unfortunately passed away a couple years back, but the health care that he received helped prolong his life. The health care that my grandmother is receiving has helped prolong her life. My children get to know who their grandmother, their great-grandmother is. That's, to me, priceless. My children, my oldest daughter will remember her, and I'm hoping she lives another 10, 15 years. What's that worth? And why did it happen? Well, because we as a society back in 1961 said, you know what, we'd like to have health insurance for our elderly. We'd like to have health insurance for them. And I'm hoping that our generation will be the one that says, you know what? I want health insurance for me. I want it for my kids. I want it for everybody. I want to make sure that people, when they're sick, they're taken care of. Here's the problem. We passed this bill. You got House Republicans threatening to cut off the funding. They couldn't repeal it. They did their little dog and pony show there. Didn't repeal it. Now they're going to do what I said they were going to do from the beginning. They're going to try and defund it. They're going to try and starve the beast. They're going to try and let it wither on the vine and die. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, Republican from Virginia, said to expect an amendment to defund the law for the rest of 2011 very soon. The guy who's going to get it, Representative Dennis Rehberg from Montana, get ready for that name. He's the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee there. He's going to get it, the honor of defunding the health care since his committee funds Health and Human Services. And by the way, did I mention that Rehberg has announced he's running for Senate in 2012? Yeah, he's running against John Tester. So this is that way to get some political mileage. This is that way to fundraise. So you can put it on the piece of paper to all the T-Twizzlers and go, hey, look, I'm your guy. I'm the guy. Here's my street cred. On Tuesday, Cantor told reporters that one way or the other, the budget bill will preclude any funding for the health care. So my first question is, one, where are the jobs? Because this does nothing to create jobs. In fact, this is going to cost us jobs. So where are the jobs? And my second question is, do they have any ideas at all of their own? Have they thought of how to lead, how to govern? Do they have any vision for what this country is going to be like in 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years? Anything? Anything at all? You got Stephen King, the Republican from Iowa. He told a town hall meeting that he wants to push to defund the law permanently. Wants to gut it all permanently. Because, you know, those 50 million plus people who don't have health care right now, you know, they get such better outcomes than the people who have Medicaid, according to one Republican. So, you know, it's probably best that they don't have health care at all. And you stop and you think about this. They ran an entire election on the idea of taking something away from us. Stealing health care from people who need it. Why? Any number of reasons. And as we go forward from this day forward, and I said this back in November, you know, it's going to be interesting watching these Republicans deal with the realities. Not the platitudes, not the campaign slogans, not the TV commercials, not that fantasy world that they dreamt up. The realities. The reality is that there are 50 million plus people without health insurance. Without health insurance in this country, folks, you don't get health care. Understand, that law was not about health care. It was about health insurance. And it did some very good things that I'm in favor of. It got rid of rescission, did away with pre-existing conditions, a bunch of good stuff. You know, preventative care, opened up some community centers, some healthcare clinics, a lot of good stuff, mammograms, all that stuff. And we've talked about that stuff ad nauseum. If the private industry was so great, they would have done these things serving their customers because their customers want this stuff. But the reality is the industry's in it. Why? They got to feed their shareholders. They got to feed Wall Street. At the end of it, it's all about Wall Street. It's all about feeding the CEO. It's all about feeding the board of directors. It's not about taking care of you. So as I look at these T-Twizzlers who have come in and these Republicans who keep talking about defunding it. We need to kill it. We need to get rid of it. It's a monstrosity. And about 16 of them have declined. I think 16 is the magic number that have declined the government health care benefits. And what's interesting is, you know, Politico did a story today on some of the stories of the new representatives who have come in, like this guy Joe Walsh from Illinois. He said, quote, I can simply honestly say that this is going to impact my wife and I to a fairly serious degree, like it would any American family out there, since he's not taking health care. What he's done, and I love it, he's contributing to a health savings account to cover his expenses and his wife's pre-existing condition. And in the coming months, as Politico reported, she's going to need a couple of procedures. She's got some problems. And why is this going to happen? Because of a political ploy. And you know what? I'm going to follow this guy because what if it turns south? What if his wife's health turns south and now it's going to bankrupt them? You know, will he turn around and say, you know what, maybe I was wrong. Maybe I made a mistake. Will he be one of those people who stands up and says, you know, we need something? Because, you know, he says, I'm not a rich guy. But we're going to stick to our ideology. We're going to pay for it out of our pocket. We've got our health savings account. So that should help us. You know, I think back to that story in the Patriot, the couple here in this listening area who is suing to overturn Obamacare because they can't buy a new car, or so they say, that being forced to buy health insurance will cost them a new car. And I look at those people and I go, personal responsibility. You know, I would love to have, and I'm looking for a new vehicle right now because my truck's on its last legs. It's 14 years old, 250,000 miles on it. It's seen better days. Time to get a new one. Time to look for something new. I would love to have a Mustang. Would love to have one of those souped up Mustangs, $50,000. Would love to have one of those big four-door pickup trucks with the all the toys, the heated seats and the heated cup holders and all that stuff. You know, $50,000. I'd love to have one of those. The reality is my wallet can only afford, you know, 15, 18. It's about personal responsibility. I will take the responsibility of living within my means and being responsible for myself. Now, taking this back to the conservative frame, don't conservatives tell us all the time that they're responsible, they're accountable? You know, personal responsibility, self-reliance. Why, you know, given the couple that's suing, choosing not to have health care, why should I be forced to secure their immaturity? Why should I be forced to bankroll their gamble? Why, because they choose to be irresponsible, should I suffer for my responsibility? I wish someone would answer that. And I go through someone like this Representative Walsh, who is putting himself in a pretty bad spot, saying I'm not going to take health care from the government. I'm going to put money into a health savings account because I have this ideology. Think about that. Remember the guy from Maryland, Representative Andy Harris, the doctor? Remember him? Who during freshman orientation demanded to know why it would take so long for him to get federal health insurance. Remember that guy? Said he had never had a job where health care didn't start on day one. How many of you had health care in the first day of your job? Not many of us. Politico points out that 85% of federal employees get insurance benefits from the federal Employee Health Benefit Program. Congress, of course, is part of the federal employees. They work for us. So I don't have a problem with people taking it, as long as they're not the ones who are trying to deny it to everyone else. So you got 16 people out there saying, you know what, we're going to let it go. We're going to let it go. We're not going to force ourselves onto this. And one guy that really caught my attention, Representative Nugent, he is a former sheriff. And, you know, like a good conservative, the good representative isn't taking the federal employees' benefits. No, no, no. What he's planning on doing and what he's done is he's bought a private plan from Blue Cross Blue Shield. And you'll never guess where he got it from. It's a plan for retired county employees. He says it's going to cost for him and his family about $1,200 a month. Does anybody see the hypocrisy in that? He doesn't want government-run health care, yet he's buying it through a government program. Am I the only one who gets this? The hypocrisy knee-deep. And you can go right down the line, and you look at these people, and they've all got different stories. And at the end of the day, a lot of them are out there putting themselves, their necks out on the line for their ideology. And I give them credit for that. I do. But again, why should I be forced to bankroll that? Why should I be the one who has to stick up for that? Last week, the House Republicans released their first round of budget cuts. You remember those? They said, "Oh, we're gonna cut $32 billion." Sorry, in the pledge we said $100 billion. All we can come up with is $32 billion. So, House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, Republican from Wisconsin, says, "Here's our $32 billion in cuts." Again, they didn't name anything specifically last week, so no programs to talk about then. Just a number. $32 billion. Of course, we had to get over the fact that we didn't meet the $100 billion threshold. Today, the Appropriations Committee, which is chaired by Republican from Kentucky, Hal Rogers, they did release some of their specific cuts. They did talk about some. Get rid of the National Endowment for the Arts. Get rid of Amtrak. Right on the chopping block, because, you know, nothing says liberal like paintings and rail. Nothing. And, of course, our chivalrous pro-birth friends have chosen to throw women and children overboard first, cutting programs that affect women and their children. For instance, there's this program called the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children. We know it as WIC. They're going to cut $758 million. That's about 6%. So all of those low-income women and their infants, sorry, no more formula, no more milk, no more. Now understand, the WIC program takes very specific nutritional information, and that's all you get. It's a great program to help make sure that children grow up healthy and strong. Again, one of those military things from back in the 20s and 30s. But they want to cut that. Boom. $750 million right there. The maternal and child health block grants. You know, this is stuff giving low-income pregnant women access to health care, mothers and their children access to health care, so that early on we catch things, we help, with fetal development, all that stuff that you would think the pro-birth people would be in favor of. They're going to cut $210 million from that. A third of their budget gone. They're also cutting $27 million from the Poison Control Center. A half of the money. Half. Now, we all know what the National Poison Control Center does. They do a great job helping people when kids, especially kids, get a hold of chemicals that are in the house and who knows what happens. Second largest cut in their budget comes to community healthcare, $1.1 billion. Now understand, in 2008, about a third of the patients who attended these community health centers were children. And at the end of this, what I argue that these cuts are going to cost us more money in the future. And I think it's going to cost us big, because if we don't catch childhood illnesses early, if we don't immunize early, if we don't do the things that need to be done at the beginning, it's going to cost us a whole bunch more down the road. And look, I understand what sacrifice is about, and I'm not against sacrifice. As long as that sacrifice is shared and proportionately shared. I'm sorry, if I've got to go from eating hamburger down to eating noodles every day, I think the very top, they should have to have hamburger at least once a month. Does that seem fair to you? Proportional. You know, not this, you know, oh, well, gee, sorry, we can't afford the extra detailing on our yacht. And you can't eat at all. I got a problem with that. Press release from the USDA. Tomorrow, evidently, the Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services, Kevin Concannon, he's going to join Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter, Paul Davis, Acting Director of AmeriCorps, and Joel Berg, Executive Director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, to swear in 46 members of the new National Anti-Hunger and Opportunity Corps. This is an AmeriCorps Vista project. The new Vista volunteers will work in both rural and urban areas in 18 states as part of a public-private partnership. You know how much I hate that, but this is a good idea to increase access to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program for Americans in need. You know, the program that the Republicans want to cut. So tomorrow we're going to look into this and maybe find out, try and get a guest to come talk to us about this. But this is part of the, First Lady Michelle Obama's goal of the Let's Move thing. This is the one-year anniversary, solving the problem of childhood obesity and promoting healthy lifestyles. Let'smove.gov is the website for that if you want to check it out. You look at the fact that they're talking about cutting the funding for this program as well. And you go, really? Is this what you have? Is this how you lead? Is this the leadership, the vision that you have for the country? Balancing your budgets on the backs of those who are really, honestly and truthfully, unable to afford it. We're going to take a quick break, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-2211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey now! Yeah, I gotta tell you, I love this article. I can't get it out of my head. This Thomas Minnery, Senior Vice President, Citizen Link, they're an affiliate of Focus on Destroying the Family. This thing that sometimes reporters ask us why we don't take on more trendy issues at Focus, you know, like poverty, you know, trendy issues, you know, things that come in and out of vogue every once in a while. I'm sorry, I didn't realize poverty was trendy. And I love the response. You know, we fight poverty in the most effective way possible. We want husbands and wives to love each other. Oh yeah, that's going to work. That's going to put food on the table. That's going to do it. It is. You know, cut all those welfare programs. Get rid of the women's infant and children, the WIC program. Get rid of that. Get rid of food stamps, which we have one in four or five children who are eating because of food stamps. Never mind that. One in six people in the country on food stamps. Never. Let them starve. Let them starve. All they have to do is love each other. That's how we can fix it. Amazing stuff. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. The other night, I declared that the recession is officially over because for the first time since 2008, credit card debt has grown. That's right. And it's grown for the third straight month, according to the AP, who reports Americans are putting more money on their credit cards. After more than 2 years of cutting back, a sign that they are gaining confidence in the economy. So, yippee! The working class of the country is done tightening its belts. Isn't that great? We saw a boost in consumer spending 3% in December. Seasonally adjusted annual rate of $2.41 trillion, according to the Federal Reserve. A third straight monthly gain. Borrowing in this category includes credit cards, which rose 3.5%. So we've seen this boost in credit cards. So I point to this story by CNN Money that harkens me back to the House, to the Senate floor speech by Senator Bernie Sanders about usury and wanting to cap credit card interest at 30%. In fact, it was amazing. I was just talking about this with somebody today about the 30% cap in the usury. Amazing that I come across this story. This woman, Toni Riss, she had a credit card with a 79.9% annual rate. 79.9. The article reads, the 58-year-old woman from Texas thought she struck gold when she found the first Premier card, which is aimed specifically at consumers with poor credit. Ms. Riss says, I had an accident on a motorcycle, went through bankruptcy to pay the medical expenses, and my credit card went basically to hell in a handbasket. So she said, I was looking for credit. I was looking for a credit card for people with bad credit, and I found it. She got a $300 credit card limit, which I guess is typical for new customers. Originally, it started at 29.9%. But as time went on, she opens up her bill, and it says, hey, congratulations, your 29.9 is going up to 79.9. Now, understand, her credit rating went where? South. Why? Medical expenses. And, you know, this is why I say this could happen to any one of us at any time. 79.9. So First Premier Bank, they launched this new card, 79.9, and there are people who are taking this because in this economy, in this country, if you don't have credit, you can't do a whole number of things. You know, you can't rent a car without a credit card. You can't get into a hotel without a credit card. You cannot book a hotel room without a credit card. So these people are, they're basically hijacked. They have to have this card. And we've seen these. You know, I've seen them 60%. I've seen them 45, 59%. I've seen these cards. And the article goes on to talk about 700,000 people have signed up for this card that they're introducing at 59.9% rate. And you go through and you read this article, which talks about a whole bunch of really bizarre practices, like charging $135 a year in fees. Starts with a processing fee to open the account of $45, the annual fee of $30 for the first year and $45 every year after that, and then a service fee just for you to have the card of six and a quarter or $75 a year. Service fee, even if you don't use it. And I look at this and I go, this is what we allow happening to the poor in this country? No wonder they're poor. They're getting high. They're getting robbed. This is a ripoff. And you look at this and you go, this is the reason we needed to have bank reform. We needed to have credit card reform. And if you remember the Card Act that passed in 2009 to protect consumers against predatory lenders, it only prevented raising rates retroactively. So when she got this notice that her credit card was going from 29.9 up to 79.9, they could only do it on the purchases that she made after getting the notice. So she was okay on what balance she was carrying. But can you imagine a 79.9% rate? I mean, loan sharks have always been in business. There's always been a demand for loan sharks. It just doesn't make it right. And that's the argument that this company's making. Well, if they'll take a 79.9% card, that kind of interest, there must be a demand for it. Now, understand how the FICO scores work. Understand how in this economy you can do nothing with a poor credit rating. This woman filed bankruptcy because of medical bills. So now she's got to go back, figure out how to repair her credit. Because you're not going to get a house loan. You're not going to get a car loan. You're not. In fact, you might not even get a job. Because most employers check your credit rating to see if you're a theft risk. You know, they want, and most employers, when they, you know, I've had people tell me this. They want people who have good credit scores, but not great. And they definitely won't take anyone with poor credit scores. But they want people who have pretty good credit scores, not great. Because they know the people at the bottom may steal from them because, you know, they're bad with money. And the people at the top who have the really good credit ratings will probably steal from them to keep that credit rating. Because they're the ones who pay their bills every month. And I look at this, and again, it goes back for me pretty simply. We're handing out credit cards to people instead of wages. We're saying, here, go spend, with no wage increases. But 79.9%. Don't you think that's highway robbery? Don't you think that's a ripoff? And I know. I know what and the libertarian side of me says, you know what, you don't have to take the card. You don't have to run up a balance. There is that part of me. There's that personal responsibility part of me. But here's the reality. And I remember my mother going through this. And when there's nothing in the house, when there's no money in the bank account and the kids need school clothes, when you need to put gas in the car to get to work so you can pay your bills, you need that little bit of elasticity. You need that little help to get to the next payday. And that's what these people are taking advantage of. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Tell me your credit card horror story. We're back after this. Sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function, then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. 520-7425. Our stat of the day comes from our friends at the Too Much Online blog. It writes, the United States ranks as the world's most unequal developed nation, but parts of the United States rank as among the most unequal places in the entire world, developing nations included. Fiscal Policy Institute notes, if New York City were a nation, its level of income concentration would be 15th worst among the 134 countries of the world that are in this, somewhere between Chile and Honduras. So we're right there with Chile and Honduras of having a moneyed elite and a massive poverty class. And I go back to this guy from Focus on Destroying the Family. We fight poverty the old-fashioned way. We ignore it. Amazing stuff. And this gets me. You know, and we've been talking about what the Republicans have done and what their plans are. And you go back to the unemployment fight during the lame duck session after the election, where they had to give not only the pound, not only a pound of flesh, but just about all of the flesh to the very wealthy in order to extend a very small lifeline to folks who are unemployed. You know, we had to give away the big Bush tax cuts to the top 2%. We had to give away the estate tax, had to give that away. We had to, make our offer at the altar of the extremely well-to-do in order just to allow the folks who have been harmed by this recession to exist. Well, today, again, the Republicans have done a very interesting thing. They have refused to extend the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program. They postponed it on Tuesday. They were going to have a vote on Tuesday. Said, we're going to do it on Tuesday, get this extended. They have turned around and said, no, not going to have that. So they haven't rescheduled the vote. House Ways and Means Ranking Member Sandy Levin, Democrat from Michigan, said during the hearing on trade issues that the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program has been a good faith effort for nearly 50 years to assist workers who have lost their jobs through trade and globalization. So you look at all these people who've lost their jobs. Why? Because we've allowed big corporations to flee this nation, to flee our borders, take the jobs with them to cheap, exploitable places, and in most parts, us paying for it as well. Because you got to remember, they get tax breaks for this. It's one of those moments where I go, you know, are we thanking someone for kicking us right between the legs there? Every time they kick us, do we have to say thank you? Or Mother, may I cover up? Changes to the TAA made in 2009 provided protections for an additional 170,000 workers, according to Sandy Levin. You look at this, and it's all because the Republican study group, their little study committee, they said the bill would cost about $620 million for the rest of this year and about $6.5 billion over 10 years. Now, what this is, and I've known a number of people who have been able to change careers because of this piece of legislation. To me, this is a failure, a massive failure by the Republicans to extend this program. And it really shows that Republicans could care less about working people. They could care less about the working people who have been basically kicked to the curb because of unfair trade deals that they have rammed down our throats with the help of corporate Democrats. This program, it's been a lifeline. And, I met a guy recently who's been unemployed for 2 years. He lost a job through because of trade. And because of the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program, he's been able to go back to school, collect his unemployment so he can support his family, he can pay his rent, do those things, not live extravagantly, but make ends meet until he finishes school. He's going to a community college. He'll have a 2-year associate's degree when he's done, and he'll be able to change careers. Because here's the reality. I'm 43 years old. When I was driving a truck, I worked for a trucking company for, working for trucking companies 20, 21, 22 years. That stuff goes away. What skills do I have to find another job? This trade adjustment assistance program helps people get the skills they need to change careers. I think of during the 80s and 90s when all the steel mills were going out of business because we couldn't compete with the Japanese and the Germans. All those guys, they ended up being able to go back to school, change careers because they were told, hey, the IT field, that's where to go. So they trained a bunch of people on computers, and for a while they had good-paying jobs. But then they allowed those to be outsourced as well. There's a problem there. There's a big problem there. And we're still talking about these trade agreements. We're talking about a trade agreement with Colombia. We're talking about a trade agreement with South Korea, with Panama. You don't think these are going to cost us jobs? We're going to have more unemployed people, more displaced, more industry lost? I think of the people who were, clothing makers. They worked in the textile industry. They were, I think of people who worked in the furniture industry in North Carolina, who that industry has been decimated. We cut down trees in this country, send them to China, and they send us finished product. Where's the sense in that? But at the end of the day, this whole ploy by the Republicans is nothing but politics as usual. They are going to hide behind, we need to cut the budget. They're going to hide behind, we have a mandate to reel in spending. But not at the cost of our nation. And I really do believe this is going to be another one of those moments in our history where we gave power to somebody and they overreached. Where we said, we want you to go ahead and do something. We want you to move forward. And they overreached way too far. Here in the state of Pennsylvania, I'm expecting this whole privatization thing to wake people up. They're gonna work on privatizing the state wine and spirits shops. They're gonna work on privatizing public education. They're gonna work on privatizing the roads and bridges. There's nothing that is sacred from privatization from these people on an ideological bound. Not that it's going to work out fiscally. They've already given up the idea that selling the state wine and spirit shops is going to net them $2 billion. They've given that argument up. They know that's not true. It's about ideology. So now they change the discussion from, we can fill the budget gap by selling these state wine and spirit shops. We can fill that budget. They've moved it from that to, core government functions. Do you want government selling you liquor? And I say, yeah, I actually do. Because we just came back from Washington, D.C. The home of liquor. On every street corner, there's liquor. You want your liquor cleaned with dry cleaning? There it is. And I got to be honest. We couldn't find any sandwich shops, but I could find liquor. Is that what we want? Is that the kind of place that we want to live in? I don't think so. While we were in Washington, the CPAC people were coming in, and Alan West, who is the big Tea Party guy, he's going to be their keynote speaker. He's going to be the one to close the conference, which is a big deal for them. And Victoria Jackson is going to be at the Victoria Jackson, right?
People.
Yeah, her. She's going to be at the big conference. Oh, boy. Wow. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. We're right back after this.
In an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shipper.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We're inspired by the youth-led
social justice movement in Egypt, and we're excited to have solidarity with workers around the world to stand behind them.
Shauna Bader-Blau of the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center from the Egyptian Democracy Movement Solidarity Rally Tuesday at the White House. Union members joined human rights activists and Egyptians worldwide calling for a peaceful transition to democracy and also called on the White House to intervene on behalf of Egyptian workers and citizens who have been threatened by Egyptian security forces. Workers in Egypt are making their voices heard in this human rights movement with strikes and demonstrations. The AFL-CIO says the labor movement in Egypt played a key role in laying the groundwork for the current widespread protests. Egyptian workers have also formed a new federation of independent Egyptian unions as the democracy movement continues to bring change to Egypt.
Workers have a lot to say about promoting social justice in a country, and when they have strength and organization, they can really come together and speak. Slavery unions are about human rights, are about the collective rights of people in a society to have the ability to fight and bargain for wages and working conditions, improvements in their work sites. And through collective bargaining and organizing, you know, in any country in the world, we can achieve a lot for our families.
Workers are still enduring a jobless hell in the U.S. Jesse Russell reports just how bad it still is.
A Labor Department employment report released on Tuesday revealed that there are still 5 unemployed workers available for every job opening in the United States. Businesses have been holding off on hiring new employees, even though some of the top businesses in the country are sitting on large profit margins. Still, that doesn't mean there hasn't been an uptick in job openings. There are 31% more jobs available on the market than in July of 2009. Economists, however, won't consider the nation in a recovery until there are 2 unemployed workers for every 1 job opening. In December, there are 4.7 unemployed workers, less than the last highest number of 6.3 unemployed workers for every job opening in November of 2009. Nearly 14.5 million people are projected to be out of work. Convincing businesses to start using some of their combined $2 trillion in assets to create more jobs and hire more workers was one of the reasons President Barack Obama held his speech to the Chamber of Commerce on Monday. Businesses contend that they can't create jobs because there simply isn't enough demand in the marketplace.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Lovett.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
Show. Remember, check out the website at therichsmithshow.com. Day 227 of the Honeywell lockout of its employees out in Metropolis, Illinois. I'm sitting here with John Smith. He's with Steelworkers District 7669, one of the workers there at Honeywell. John, thanks for talking to me.
Thank you, Rick. Nice to finally meet you in person.
Yeah, we've spoken a couple of times over this 227 days, and, you know, I'm not getting the point. They throw you out into the street. They bring in scab workers. They can't possibly be turning a profit. What's all this about?
It's about putting the thumb on the working class. It's the same thing the rest of the country's dealing with. That, you know, we're in a class war, and somebody's got to fight it, or you know, we're going to be the next third world country.
So let's go back. What exactly do you guys do out there in Illinois?
We take uranium ore from the mines, and we process it into UF6 gas, which is then further enriched for nuclear fuel.
And this sounds like a fairly knowledge-based job. I mean, you really got to know what you're doing here, I think.
It is, and we deal with a lot of hydrofluoric acid. As a matter of fact, they ordered, even after the lockout, they ordered their hydrofluoric acid based on what we were producing in the plant. Well, they've made it apparent they're not producing that because these rail cars of hydrofluoric acid are starting to pile up outside the plant. As a matter of fact, we're going to go talk about it a little later today on the hill, but there's 7 rail cars. There's about 1 million pounds of HF that's about 30 yards from the road and about a quarter mile from an airport.
You've got 7 rail cars full of hydrofluoric acid.
Anhydrous,
sitting?
Anhydrous, aqueous, hydrofluoric acid sitting about 30 yards from the road. You or I, if we were in Metropolis today, could walk up to them.
Really?
Really.
Explain what could happen if some of that got released. Because when I hear anhydrous, I think of horrible, horrible death.
Yeah. They say one rail car would cause fatalities and injuries in all of Metropolis, a lot of Paducah. And you'll be able to smell it as far north as St. Louis, Missouri, and as far south as Clarksville, Tennessee.
And they're just sitting there. And,
sitting there.
What have our regulatory bodies done? Was OSHA done? What is, anything?
Nothing yet. OSHA actually tried to go on the, well, they did go on the plant yesterday, and by law we're allowed a representative to go with them, and it was a representative from the Steelworkers International Health and Safety Department, and Honeywell stopped them at the door, told them they were not a current employee, and sent them back out. So then we sent another one of our members, that's also a member of the executive board, to go accompany OSHA because they are an employee, and they blocked them also, and we didn't get a formal reason for that, except for they didn't want us in there.
So basically, you're going to have to get a court.
We're going to have to get a court order, and so the real question is, what are they hiding that they don't want us to find out? Because obviously, we're going to have more knowledge about specific things in that plant than the OSHA inspectors are. Not to say they won't do their job, but they're just not going to have the same knowledge base that we do.
Because as I understand, you're the only place in the country that does this.
Right, the only one.
So I wouldn't assume that OSHA would have all that much intimate knowledge.
No, and the plant's really funny because the OSHA only regulates a section of the plant. The NRC regulates a section of the plant. EPA regulates a section of the plant. So it's multiple agencies, and it's hard to get them there because a lot of times I think they falsely assume that the other agencies are taking care of it.
Well, one would think, John, that, in looking at this scenario where you've got some unrest, you've got some problems, you're doing a job with people who are, I would have to admittedly say, less skilled, less able. To me, that sounds like ripe for trouble.
Right, and I wouldn't call it untrained, but I would call them undertrained. And it is ripe for trouble. I mean, they've had several incidents so far in the plant, and it's only a matter of time. I'm telling you, it's only a matter of time before they kill somebody in there.
Yeah, I mean, yesterday there was an explosion in Texas. Still not sure why that happened. They're missing one person, and I'm hoping that he's off on a drinking binge somewhere and not seeing the news, other than where sadly, I think he may actually be. But you look at these places and deadly serious consequences to one mishap.
Right, and they don't care at all about the regulators anyway. It's the price of doing business for them is considered it's cheaper for them to pay the fine than to follow the rules.
So in going back through all of this, have you been negotiating? Have they been to the table? Are you moving towards any resolve whatsoever here?
Well, we've been at a pretty good stalemate, but we did go back to the table yesterday. We are back there today, and we will be back there tomorrow. And so nothing was agreed upon yesterday, but there was some dialogue, so we're hoping we can wrap at least a couple things up today. But still yet, we're a long ways off from having a contract that we can live with.
I look at this, and then I go back to the fact that our labor laws are broken in this country, that you can have workers who want to do their jobs kicked to the curb. Because as I understand, you guys were willing to work under the old contract while you were. Am I
right,
wrong
right.
here?
We agreed. We agreed to work with a contract extension, without a contract extension. It really didn't matter. We were willing to continue to work and negotiate until we got an agreement, and that lasted for 7 days before they kicked us out.
And the employer just said, "There's the door."
Yeah, so basically, I went into work that night, and you have to. Obviously, you can't wear the clothes that you drove in your car into the plant, but I changed clothes and I come out of the locker room there, and there was a manager that told me to change back and leave the property.
Absolutely amazing. And again, this is why I go back to the fact that we need to have some major, major labor law reform in this country. John, I wish you guys nothing but the best out there, and I hope you'll come back and give us some updates as this continues Again, one of these, day 227 of the Honeywell lockout. Amazing stuff. John, thanks so much.
All right, appreciate it, Rick.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
When corporate executives needed a political favor, they always went running to Congress. But now, they can also run to the courthouse. Over the years, corporate chieftains and their political henchmen have steadily ensconced reliable laissez-faire ideologues in hundreds of federal judgeships, quietly creating a corporate-friendly path for moving their litigation all the way from the district level through the Supremes. For example, in its effort to scuttle Obama's health care reform, the right wing has gone court shopping. They file their cases in the courts of judges who are known to be ideologically hostile to government regulation of health care corporations. Take U.S. District Judge Henry Hudson in Virginia. On December 13th, he ruled that a key provision of the new law is unconstitutional, a ruling at odds with 14 other federal judges who had dismissed similar challenges. He had to resort to twisted reasoning to reach his decision and keep the right wing's flawed case moving. But hey, you can't let legal niceties get in the way of ideology. Peek under Hudson's judicial robe and you'll find a naked partisan with a long career in hard right Republican politics. Protege of Ronald Reagan and his detestable Attorney General Ed Meese, Hudson ran unsuccessfully for a Virginia congressional seat in 1991, then was given two GOP political appointments in the state before George W. lifted him onto the federal bench in 2002. This is Jim Hightower saying, even today, as he sits in judgment of politically motivated cases, Hudson continues to draw annual income as an owner of a Republican political consulting firm. One of the firm's successful clients in 2009 was Ken Cuccinelli, who was elected to be Virginia's Attorney General. Ken just happens to be the official who filed the right wing's case against Obama's health care reform in Judge Hudson's court.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.com.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
Today, back in 1917, wobbly activist Tom Mooney, convicted of bombing that he didn't do. He was framed by the Pinkertons, who orchestrated the bombing. He was pardoned, but took him 22 years to clear his name. You know, these are the kind of people who stood up and fought for the rights that we have today on the job. These are the kind of people who wanted to make things better, like the folks up in Poconos, up in Monroe County at the Pocono Medical Center, standing up, fighting to make their working conditions just a little bit better, fighting to make their own personal situations a little bit better, asking for a very small amount of the profits that they produce. Seems reasonable to me. Also on this day, back in 1937, Congress approved legislation allowing for a total of 940 million dollars to be used for depression era relief projects. Understand, almost 800 million of that was to be used to fund work relief and flood recovery programs. So you know, you hear about all of those things that the WPA did, all those great building projects, all the roads and all the big bridges, and I remember seeing them. You'd see the date right on them, you know, the year right on them, still being used today, you know, 60, 70 years later. We need that again today. Well, we got in Congress, you got a bunch of Republicans who are saying, oh, no, we don't want to create jobs. We want to talk about it. We want to say, oh, you got to create jobs. But we don't have a clue how to do that. We don't want to spend the money to make sure that that's created. We want tax cuts for our wealthy friends. Because if you remember, the stimulus bill, that's what it was. It was 40% of it were tax cuts. That, again, I still haven't figured out where tax cuts create jobs. Demand creates jobs. When you want a high-speed rail line, you don't give somebody a tax cut. You put the money out, you build the rail line. It's that simple. Also today, in the year 2000, more than 19,000 Boeing engineers and technical workers in Washington State and Oregon began what was to become a 40-day strike over economic issues, saying, hey, look, we want a fair wage. We want some of the profits that we create. And look, we don't want any more than that. And I think that's a fair reality. And I ask even people who know nothing about being part of the union, do you not want a fair share of what you create? I hear this ridiculous notion that, well, these employers give us jobs. Yeah, they give us jobs. Only when they can make a profit off of you. And, that's the thing. Every job I've ever gotten in my life, it's because the guy who hired me said, I can make a dime off of you. And I can make more money than what I'm paying you. It's the only way this game works. But if you're making money for the boss, you should get a little bit of it. Anyway, the Republicans, again, I'm telling you, this is going to be another one of these years where we see some overarching. Scott Perry, he's a Republican here in the area. Dilsburg state representative, he's put forth a joint resolution proposing an amendment to the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, providing for a secret ballot election for employee representation. Yeah, what they want, they want to demand that everyone has to go through the election process, the secret ballot process. Has no co-sponsors at this point. It's still new. They've just reserved the number and the name. But understand, Perry's going to get a nice kickback from this. He's going to get some good funding out of this. He's going to get some money to put into his pocket. Because this is one of those things that's going across the country. Republicans have picked up seats in legislatures across the country. And you know what? They see workers as the enemy. They see them coming together and organizing as a destructive thing, and they're out for blood. Tom Mooney back in 1917, they framed, can't do that anymore, really. So what are we going to do? We're going to destroy the other means. We're going to destroy every means. And that's what they've been doing. Four states across the country have voted to amend their state's constitution so that, the right to the secret ballot in union elections only is sacrosanct. This is four states: Arizona, South Carolina, South Dakota, Utah. Not hotbeds of unionization, but in South Carolina and Utah, the secret ballot is absolute, according to their constitution. Now, it's absolute. Workers and companies, they have no choice. The government has put themselves right in the middle of this. So even if both sides agree, they're forced by government intervention to hold an election. Even if everybody agrees, the government, they want the government, the anti-government people want to put themselves right in the middle of your business. Also in Arizona, South Dakota, a secret ballot is required when there's a law permitting it on state or federal level. So if the state says it has to be, it has to be. If the federal law says you're part of it, it has to be as well. Now, understand. Back on January 13th of this year, the National Labor Relations Board's general counsel, a guy named Laf Solomon, wrote the four states' attorneys generals and basically said, hey, look, what you've done is basically worthless and unconstitutional. There's a thing called the Supremacy Clause that in the U.S. Constitution that says, if it's something the federal government's done, it's how it is. The federal government supersedes state laws when it conflicts with federal laws. And here's why. The government keeps its nose out of employer-employee relations and lets the employer choose whether or not. Now, understand, it's the employer who chooses whether or not they're going to recognize a union without the election. The employer. Had we passed the Employee Free Choice Act, that would have moved from the employer to the employee, to where if you had the right a number of signatures of cards, the employees decided to surpass the ballot election. It's not gone. It's not gone. The people would have had it under the Employee Free Choice Act. Now, even to this day, with nothing having been passed since the 30s and then amended in the 40s, nothing's changed. If 30% of the workers want a union, they go to the boss and say, you know what, 30% of the workers want to have a union. The boss can say, okay, I recognize it. And there's no election. There's no fighting. You come to an agreement. Why do we want the government? Why do we want this outside entity involved in that? Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So what happened? You got a bunch of these congressional Republicans who were angry about this, that the National Labor Relations Board General Counsel would write this to the four states. So what did they do? They introduced something called the Secret Ballot Protection Act. They want to amend the National Labor Relations Act, making it an unfair labor practice for an employer to recognize a union without the ballot, without the secret ballot. And it's also against the law for unions to seek that recognition, which I thought was even interesting as well. So that what they want is they want to put the government that they so despise right between you and your employer. Because they've decided what's right for you, I guess. Also, on January 27th, the four attorneys generals sent a letter to the general counsel stating, quote, "We will defend these provisions in our state constitutions if they are challenged. But we also firmly believe that lawsuits by the federal government to attack these provisions would be misguided. Such lawsuits not only would cost the taxpayers substantially, but would seek to undermine individual rights that the NLRA and our state and federal constitutions protect." So, final chapter so far. I'm sure this is going to be ongoing. The general counsel said, hey, look, to resolve this matter without the unnecessary expenditure of taxpayer money, maybe there's something we can work out. Maybe we can figure it out. So it's going to cost us one way or another. We, the taxpayers, are going to pay a boatload of money for this political assassination, because that's what this is. It's a political hit job. Republicans hate organized workers. They hate the fact that people who engage in collective bargaining generally, and I wish this weren't the case, generally vote for Democrats, because Democrats are the ones who say, you know what, we believe in collective bargaining, we believe in the right of assembly, we right of redress of grievances, we believe in all that stuff that the Constitution tells us we should have, but they believe in it for the workplace as well. And, you know, when we talk about all these rights that we seem to have, we only have those rights against our government. We don't have those rights on the job. We don't have those rights in public or on private property. We don't have those rights. So once you cross that threshold into your employer's place of business, you're basically their slave. They can basically have you do anything they want, and the only recourse that you have is to leave. So now if you've got a job in this economic climate, where, you know, you got kids, you got a mortgage, you got a car payment, you're struggling to get by, things are piling up, and the boss says, you know what, I need you to come in on Saturday, but I can't pay you. Work through your lunch, or hey, you know, don't take a break, just keep working. What are you going to say? You going to stand up for yourself? Chances are you're not. And chances are you're going to put up with it. And they know that, which is why they're so dead set against collective bargaining. And you're seeing this across the country. But here in this state, we're going to see an awful lot more of this, more of these political hit jobs, more of these paybacks, because that's what this is. It's a big payback. And for me, these are the folks who are anti-government. These are the people who don't think government should do anything, yet they want to interject the government that they hate. If you could explain it to me, I'd love to hear it, but they want to interject the government that they hate into your business. Now, you know me. There are certain things I think government should do. Healthcare, liquor stores, not bad. Dealings between me and my employer, not so much. Dealings between me and my spouse and my house, not at all. Dealing between me and my kids, not at all, unless some kind of abuse is going on. At the end of this, folks, this is a massive overreach. And this is the kind of stuff we better get used to. Because Republicans aren't anti-government. No, no, they want to use it for their purposes. But the purposes of the past. And you go back and you read about labor's history. You go back and read about the struggles of working people and how the government was used against them by the big corporate special interests. That's what we're reliving. This is the kind of stuff that we're going to start to see. You know, I go back to the injunctions. When they had injunctions against workers meeting. In fact, they even had an injunction that workers couldn't sing songs. They couldn't even sing songs. Think about that. You know, we love to talk about the freedom of speech. We love to talk about the freedom of assembly, the freedom to redress our grievances. Yet, not in the workplace, not on the shop floor. You know, we've seen stories of people being fired for wearing buttons. We've fought that battle. We've seen tons of this stuff. Yet at the end of it, folks, at the end of it, it's just up to us to fight. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Todd on line one. How are we doing tonight, Todd?
Rick, how you doing? Doing all right, you know, laid off like a lot of my brothers and sisters out there.
Sorry to hear that, brother.
You know, I've been listening to you for a while now, and I live in Pennsylvania. I live in Philadelphia. And when are we going to start marching in the streets?
That's what I've been calling for.
Yeah, I mean, I remember back in the day, marches on Harrisburg and all kinds of stuff, you know, at just the sniff of right to work. And, you know, what's going on? I mean, are you hearing anything? Because I'm not hearing anything.
May 3rd, there is going to be a big action. They're going to be buses of people from around the country, around the state here, to march on Harrisburg. The Clear Coalition is having their event. We're going to be there. I'm hoping that folks from Philadelphia and from Pittsburgh and from all across this state come and let their legislators know that this budget, and not only is this budget a moral document, this budget is a show of priorities, and the laws that they're looking to pass, I'm telling you, a hit job on you and me, a real screw job.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my wife, she was raised down south. And she was working in Nashville, and you know, right to work state in Tennessee. And you know, they fired her for no reason whatsoever, and she couldn't do anything at all. And you know, to a degree, it was kind of a good thing because then she got her job working for the Department of Defense up here, and then we met. But still, it's bull. It's absolute bull.
Well, let me just jump in here for a second, Todd. I think what people need to know about the state of Pennsylvania, it's just not Tennessee. Here in Pennsylvania, unless you break a federal law firing somebody, there's nothing that you can't be fired for.
Yeah, that's true.
This is an at-will employment state unless you have a union contract, which, you know, I tell people you need to have that contract, even if you never need it. And I know people who've never had a grievance, have never had a problem, but they're part of a union and they're thankful that they are.
Oh, absolutely. I'm third generation. I really, and honestly, you know, growing up, I kind of was like, oh, no, I'm not going to do it, you know, and then I ended up doing it anyways. So it's a good life. It's a good, honest life. And you can provide for your family and pay back into your community. But they don't see it that way.
And that's the thing that bothers me. And I look at this piece of legislation that Scott Perry's proposing, this idea that we have to have ballot elections for everything, basically interjecting the government in our business.
And
he's a guy who's an anti-government guy, ran on the platform of small, ineffective government, yet for beating up on workers, boy, he's all for it.
Yeah. Well, is he in a, is he an anti-abortion guy too?
Cause, yeah.
Yeah, that's the same in the same vein. It's, you know, oh well, okay. You know, you don't want the government regulating banks and, you know, healthcare and things of that nature, but you know, you want them regulating people's bodies and choices and, you know, their bedrooms essentially and marriage and all that.
Yep.
You know.
He's a pro-birth guy, is what I say.
Yeah.
You know, he wants to make sure that the child is born and then basically screw you, you're on your own.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
Todd, I appreciate the call, buddy. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
All righty. You know, and look, you know, that's pretty much how it is. You've got these folks who, quite frankly, that's their ideology, pro-birth. And interestingly enough, and it was a segue that I didn't even come up with, we're seeing that the other grand wet dream ideology that the Republicans have pushed for years to get rid of abortion so that we can be completely pro-birth is they're launching a new effort to defund Planned Parenthood. They're doing that on the federal level right now in the House Appropriations Committee. Their chairman, Hal Rogers, is trying to remove all $327 million from Title X programs as the GOP pushes forth its bill to block the funding to Planned Parenthood. Also, you're going to see a bill on the state level to defund Planned Parenthood. Understand what Planned Parenthood does. Before I take a break, I think it's important that we understand. They provide women's health services, not just abortions, to low-income people. To me, that is extremely important. So this idea that Planned Parenthood is only it's an abortion clinic, it's not. It's much, much more than that. A very small amount of its spending does go towards giving women that choice, of which personally, for me, myself, I'm against. But for you, what do I have the right to tell you what you can do? What does the government have the right to tell you what to do with your body? That's my position on it. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Executive Director of CAIU on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Gasoline, groceries, and our hate is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. At the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference here in Washington, D.C., I'm here with Carl Davidson, Associate Steelworker Member, Good Jobs, Green Jobs Attendee, and self-described agitator. Carl, thanks for sitting down with me.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Why the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference?
Well, I grew up in Beaver County, which is north of Pittsburgh. We used to have the largest steel mill in the world. When I was a kid, it was the most blue-collar county in the country. Now it's the oldest population county in the country. We export young people. There's some young people who are so poor they can't move. We have a crisis, like in the town of Aliquippa. We have thousands of young people who've never even had a job of any kind. every so often a helicopter comes in, arrests a couple dozen of them for the drug trade, takes them away to jail. A few weeks later, a couple dozen other kids fill the posts, and it goes on. It's a vicious cycle. It's destroying us. And the only way I can see to resolve that problem is to put these kids to work. And the Green Jobs Program and Good Jobs Green Card Program is a way to put them into work so that they can have a career path out of poverty.
No, really, any job program would be helpful. But
anything would be helpful.
But maybe not going back to the old days of, you know, the mills spewing pollution in the air.
Well, that's over. That's not going to happen. What we have to do is, I think Leo Girard for the steelworkers is on target with his, you know, advanced green manufacturing, his industrial policy. The new mills of the future are going to be like Gamesa making windmills and wind turbines. It's not going to be the old smokestack stuff. We can have some mills where we make boutique steel, where we re-smelt aluminum from recycled aluminum, things like that. But there's no way we're going to compete in basic steel with China, Brazil, places like that.
Yeah, especially the old methods that they're using.
No, especially because, you know, we had the largest steel mill in the world for a long time, but it was, four open hearth furnaces. It was very old technology. When they gutted it in order to speculate in oil futures and left the rest of us to suffer.
Yeah, you know, you look at how the economy has turned, and most of the jobs that are leaving this country end up in places like China, India, Brazil, places where they don't have the environmental standards that we would expect here. And this argument that we need to deregulate and we need to, as Darrell Issa has said, we need to get rid of these pesky regulations to help the job creators. And the question is do we want to go back to those dirty industries where you're sacrificing years of your life just to make a living?
The whole neoliberal argument rests on a false assumption. Their assumption is that the economy is two-sided, buyers and sellers. When an economy has really got three players, a buyer, a seller, and a cop, and it's been that way from day one, there's a role for government, even if it's to set fair weights and measures, to set standards. Without those, you don't have a market. In Beaver County, the reason we have markets in Beaver County is because George Washington and his army built the Broadhead Road. If they hadn't had that government intervention, there would be no market.
You talk about this with folks, and they think, well, you're right. They see the marketplace as buyers and sellers. But like any game,
right.
I've never played a game where there are no rules.
And
never
you need an umpire.
I had someone tell me recently, well, there's that UFCW fighting. No, there are rules in that. You can't kill somebody. You can't put their private parts off. There are rules, so I've yet to find anything where there are absolutely no rules. So why would we have why would we want an economy with no rules?
Right. What ends up is you end up going back to what existed before real markets, which was pillage and plunder.
Well, and if you look at our economy over the years, we've gotten into these cycles of boom bust,
right,
where things are really, really great, and the wealthy are sharing a little bit, and then boom. They go away and everybody.
I talked to, in Beaver County, we go face to face. We have an anti-war rally every week outside the county courthouse, and sometimes the Tea Party's out there. They have their rally. So we talked to them. So I talked to this one guy who was carrying on about taxes. I said, look, you're a small businessman. Now tell me honestly, which would you rather have right now, more customers or a tax break?
But he'd rather have a tax break if he was
no, but he told me he would rather have more.
Vacation.
I obviously would rather have more customers. Tax break wouldn't do him a goddamn good.
Well, tax breaks do business owners a good if
they want to go on vacation. But yeah. If they want to expand, if they want to grow, they need more customers.
Absolutely.
And the only way they get more customers is more demand. Demand creates jobs. And when people don't have the money, that's where government comes in.
Well, which is why the banks gave us credit cards.
Exactly.
We couldn't.
The problem is, they got all the 18%, 20% interest rate off of it. If we'd be like North Dakota and had a state bank, we'd be much better off.
Well, and you go back to when Bernie Sanders wanted to cap credit card fees at 30%, interest at 30%, and they said that was not high enough.
That's usurious. That's what they call the sin of usury. Yeah. I'm an old Catholic boy. That's a sin of usury right there.
But 30% wasn't high enough.
I know. It's outrageous.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Carl Davidson, self-described agitator, activist. So bringing you back here to this Good Jobs, Green Jobs conference, what do you take from this? What do you go back to Aliquippa, Pennsylvania with?
Well, what I do is I go back, and first of all, I'm a blogger. So we have a blog called Beaver County Blue. So I'll write it up. And
I have seen that. Right. I've read it a number of times.
It's a... we try to educate the constituency we work with. The blog is an instrument of the 4th Congressional District Progressive Democrats of America. And so we have about 400 people engaged in our organization, so we try to educate them. But the main thing I also try to do is, from the things I learn here in the different workshops, what we really need to pull together in, say, Aliquippa, is a Green Jobs Collaborative. I need to find a home improvement company that's looking for work. I need to get a youth agency in some churches in the black community. I need to pull in some union apprenticeship programs. I need to talk to the Beaver County Community College and say, look, all of us, let's form a collaborative. Let's try to get some Obama bucks. That's not going to be easy these days with the Republicans. And so that we can fund a job, so that we can start winterizing all the public buildings in town, and we can put some of these kids to work on a career path. To me, it's a no-brainer. We did it under FDR. We've got Raccoon Creek State Park, which is one of the nicest ones around here. It was all built by the WPA and the CCC, and we're still benefiting from it. So what we have to do is just do the 21st century version of that, which is a green jobs program for the unemployed kids in the county.
You know, you talk about the programs of yesteryear, and right when this economic collapse happened, exactly what you're talking about is what I said we should have done right from the beginning. Instead of handing out tax breaks, instead of saying, here, folks who are already, doing very well, here's more, we should have taken that money, invested in building projects, getting job training, to get folks into the jobs and the careers of the future.
Isn't it interesting, though? All the guys who talk about the market, as soon as they lose, they want government help.
Yeah, well, for you and I, it's cutthroat capitalism.
Right, but
for the big corporations, they absolutely want socialism.
What do we do?
We bailed out the banks. We bailed out Wall Street. But, you know, when you lost your job because of them, sorry, bud, you're free market. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
The hypocrisy is amazing.
You go back to the TARP thing, and now look, as much as I hated TARP, as much as I hated the fact that we bailed the banks out, we had to do it because it would have hurt us even more than it hurt them.
Well, you know what my view was then? My view was buyout, not bailout. Let them all go down, let them crash down to penny stock status, buy them all up, and then take them over.
Yeah, the problem with that is, again, we go back to this whole scenario, this doomsday scenario where the credit markets freeze and all businesses cease to exist. I was in favor of taking them over, breaking them up, and going back to the days of having reasonable-sized community banks.
Reinforced Glass-Steagall, separate, wild speculation from normal banking services.
And put a transfer tax on every stock
trade. There you go. Absolutely. Take some of that surplus value back.
There you go. Well, I mean, it's not even surplus value. It's inflated speculative value.
Gambling winnings.
Yeah, it is what it is.
That's exactly what it is.
And maybe we should be looking at that. So, again, when you go back, you're going to take this idea of a collaboration of business, of labor, education, and try and bring this together to promote some green retrofitting, because the president was in Pennsylvania last week talking about just this very thing, how to retrofit commercial buildings to help make them more energy efficient, thus saving us a boatload of money.
I say, there's also, I'll put my own value added on it because I'm an old radical. So to me, it's not just enough to get a Green Jobs Collaborative. There's two ways to do a Green Jobs Collaborative. You can hire a bunch of kids. You can get a construction company to make some money retrofitting these homes. And then after the money's run out, all the kids are dumped on the street. My idea is, while you're doing this, get the kids in an apprenticeship program, send them through the community college thing, and help them form a green jobs cooperative. a home repair cooperative. So that when they come out of it, they have an ongoing business that's worker-owned.
Oh, my God, you said that word, that C word.
Yeah, but
that cooperative, oh, that's communism. How dare you?
Not quite. Not quite.
Well, I mean, that's what
our friends on the extreme right would say. It's very much in tune with what the steelworkers have done, though, because they've opened up a partnership with the largest co-op in the world, which is the Mondragon co-ops in Spain.
Right.
Which I visited last September. And I think there's a lot there for us to learn. If the government can't take initiative to form, and private industry can't take initiative, and this is what Leo Girard was saying with his initiative forming his partnership with the Mondragon co-ops. If you guys are not going to do it, we're going to find a way to do it ourselves. Set up a network of worker-owned businesses.
And that's the key. We got to figure out how to do it ourselves.
Right.
We don't need the international, the transnational capitalists. Carl, great talking to you. I appreciate sitting down with you. Enjoy the rest of the conference. Thanks so much.
All right.
I want to take a quick break. We're right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Your working class radio experience. Where hard work, common sense, and rational thoughts are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left. Reaching out of poverty. Father, son, left the cameo.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Lots there to see and do. You can download our podcast. You can watch the video. You see me sitting here in the studio ranting and raving, waving my arms around. I appreciate all of our video watchers and our podcast folks. If you want to email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com, I do appreciate the contact and do answer all emails personally. It may take me a minute or two, but I do get around to it. And I want to thank everybody who does reach out to us here at the program. Your input is appreciated and important. Today, President Obama proposed a piece of his 2012 budget that will severely cut, what they're saying, several $1 billion from the LIHEAP program, which, as we know, the LIHEAP funds poor people so that they can heat their homes, according to the National Journal. They're saying it's the biggest domestic spending cut disclosed so far and one that will likely generate the most heat for the president's traditional political allies, you know, people like me, Such complaints might satisfy the White House, they say, which has a vested interest in convincing Americans that it is serious about budget discipline. I got to be honest. To me, budget discipline is not about punishing poor people. Budget discipline is not about kids to bed at night hungry. Budget discipline is not about cutting jobs programs. Budget discipline is not about cutting funding to schools. Talk here in the state of Pennsylvania, Tom Corbett's talking about $1 billion in cuts to education. To me, sorry, that's not budget discipline. That's plain stupid, but also misguided, short-sighted, and just plain dumb. If you stop investing today, if you stop investing in the future today, what will you have in the future? If you stop putting money into education, what type of children, what kind of educated citizens will we have in the future? Who's going to take care of me when I get older? And I guess I have to start couching things in that me frame. You know, people who are in their 40s like me, you know, retirement's a ways off. And our kids are going to be the ones that are taking care of us. So we'd better educate them to the best possible way possible, man. I think I want surgeons who are going to be able to replace my hip when I have to have it replaced and not end up allowing it be infected so we have to chop off the whole leg. I would like to have a nursing staff that's not going to mix up my medicines if I'm in the hospital. I would like to have competent people, and that comes back to education. And if we stop funding these things, if we say, yeah, you know what? Never mind. We'll let the private sector do it. We'll privatize education like they're trying to do here in the state of Pennsylvania. We'll privatize all of the commons, all of what is ours, the roads, the bridges, privatize it all. The state wine and spirit shops, privatize it all. And then what happens? What happens to your society? You have a society of those who have an awful lot and those who have none. And by all accounts, you know, you see study after study, survey after surveying, the United States is one of the most unequal societies on the planet. The difference here, though, and understand, you know, we're between, what, Chile and Honduras? Understand the difference between the most unequal here in the United States and the most unequal in a place like Chile or Honduras are worlds apart. The poorest people here still have the ability to get something to eat. Understand that. We're talking about the difference in wealth in this country. And for me, it comes back down to some simple things. And, you know, my hope for President Obama has been dashed. That hope that he would be the guy who saves work. The guy who proposes those New Deal type plans like we talked about earlier, you know, almost $1 billion of investment in the country back in 1937 to build projects, parks and roads and bridges and schools and hospitals and post office and all the things that went into building our nation and putting people back to work. That's what I had hoped for. Instead, what we got during the second worst economic crisis of the last century, what we got were 40% tax cuts. We didn't get the investment that you got during the New Deal. You know, what do you think would have happened back during the Depression had Roosevelt come out and said, you know what, we're going to spend almost $1 billion on a recovery package, but $400 million of it I'm going to have to give in tax breaks to the top couple of percent. What do you think would happen? Back then, people were desperate enough to riot, and they were in the streets. And maybe, like Todd said earlier, maybe that's what we need. And so on May 3rd, when the Clear Coalition and some labor groups bring people here to Harrisburg to hold a rally, maybe you get out of the buses. Maybe you find out how you get down here. And if you're listening to the program and you want to find out, email me, and I'll put you in touch with somebody to help you get down here, because I think it's vital that we have thousands of people here in Harrisburg on May 3rd. I think it's vital that we fill that Capitol with people knocking on their legislators' doors saying, hey, cut the nonsense. We're watching. And when the next election comes around, we will remember what you're doing right now. So all of this ridiculous stuff that they're trying to pull, like making Pennsylvania a right-to-work state, doing away with prevailing wage laws, this ballot thing that Perry's, this stunt that Perry's pulling, cutting funds to the programs that are vital to our community, cutting libraries, cutting education, cutting health care, the adult basic thing. We're going to remember that in 2 years. And somebody's going to have to pay the price. And that's why we're here to remind you when that comes around. That's why programs like this, independent media, is so important. And when we talked earlier to Lori LeBeau about the freelance journalists, and the folks over at Huffington Post who, I thought did a very good job. They're doing a great job of investigative journalists. I didn't know they didn't get paid. And I'm really hoping that down the road they figure out how to let us know who the good citizens are and who the ones who aren't so good are. So we can help those who are doing the right thing. Because that's how it's got to work. We got to watch out for one another. You know, we are all in this together, no matter what the right wants us to believe. No matter what we hear coming out of Congress, out of the House of Representatives about, oh, you need to pull yourselves up by your bootstraps. You're an individual. We're in this together. You know, we're a collection of individuals, if you want. But we still have a common goal, a common purpose. And I think that common goal and that common purpose is to make this country the greatest place to live on earth. That has an economy that works for everybody. That has opportunity, be it education, employment, to move forward. And that takes help from you and me. Yeah, you know, I hate paying taxes like anybody else. You know what I hate paying taxes over? Republicans doing dumb things. Like these stunts, like this healthcare stunt. They spent a couple of days fighting to repeal healthcare, even though they knew it wasn't going to go anywhere. They knew it was a dog and pony show. They knew it was kabuki theater. But they chose to go ahead anyway. They chose to go ahead and waste taxpayer dollars. They chose to waste time. When their charge, no matter what they tell you, their charge was jobs. What have they done to create jobs? Nothing. Nothing at all. Former President George W. Bush's top environmental regulator urged him in 2008 to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Bet you didn't know that. According to a letter released by a Democratic lawmaker, his top guy, Stephen Johnson, who is the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, who the Republicans want to destroy and go after, told Bush he was obligated to declare gases from power plants, cars, and other sources as a danger to the public, according to a 2008 press letter released to the press today. Henry Waxman from California, the ranking Democrat on the House Energy and Commerce Committee, produced that letter today. Bush's EPA chief wrote that, quote, the latest climate change science doesn't permit the administration to declare that carbon isn't a threat or that more research is needed. So basically the guy wanted to do the right thing, and they hushed him up. You know why they hushed him up? Well, because of Cheney and all those meetings that we're not allowed to know anything about. And we'll probably never know, because I'm sure a lot of those notes burnt up in that fire that they had. Remember that fire? Kind of convenient, I think. But it's kind of interesting. Now you go back and you're starting to see people coming out talking about what happened during the Bush years and how they sequestered all of the rational thought that went on during that period. It's absolutely amazing to me. And you know what's going to happen? Nothing. Because we have this dead dogs lie mentality. Amazing stuff. I want to thank all my guests who were on the program tonight. I want to thank you for being here. And thank you Brent for moving the slides and tubes. We're hitting the clock. We're out of here. See you tomorrow night.
Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the sway. Imperial.